Hi everyone, this is Thursday the 23rd of January 2014 and welcome to session two of this year's Ontology Summit, which is track A on common reusable semantic content. So if we look at the agenda slides, I'm just quickly going to run through the agenda before handing it over to one of my co-champions. So next slide, please. Slide two. So just to quickly recap the mission statement for track A, basically we've seen that ontologies and semantic technologies such as reasoning play a major role in the semantic web. And one challenge in these efforts is to be able to make use of common semantic content so people don't keep having to create new ontologies and thereby avoid having silos of different ontologies. But there are a number of challenges with that, and so the goal of achieving commonality and reuse still seems to be a bit elusive. So what we're really looking at in this track is how to make better use of existing ontologies. Look at things like foundational top-level ontologies and broad domain models that exist as starting points for reuse. But at the moment, the amount of reuse still seems to be quite low in practice. So really, that's what this track is going to explore. Next slide, please. Slide three. So we're going to be discussing the reuse problem in this and the next session in 5 weeks' time, and look at possible solutions such as the use of ontology repositories and tools, use of common semantic content, making ontologies accessible, perhaps in more small accessible pieces and so on, and also to try and find exemplary content that can be reused and figure out what are the things that one needs by way of related information and so on to actually get better use and reuse of ontologies in different applications and services, and to identify where more work is needed as well. And we're looking not just at reuse within semantic web applications, but also how ontologies can be better reused in linked data and in big data applications and so on. So that's really the outline of what this track is about. Slide four, please. So here's what we're going to do today. So we had the launch event last week, and we had a nice overview of the overall program for this year's Ontology Summit, and in particular how we can better cross-pollinate between different communities, semantic web and big data and so on. So today's session is track A, so we're focusing on common reusable semantic content. We're going to start with a short introduction to the problem space, an exploration of what all the different issues and opportunities are and so on. And then we'll have three specific presentations looking at different aspects of ontology reuse and different qualities of ontologies. So we'll have one example from the earth sciences domain focusing on semantic alignment between a couple of different ontologies using ontology design patterns. Then we'll have an example looking at the issue of reuse and some practical experience of trying to reuse material both from ISO 15926 and from the Financial Industry Business Ontology. And then finally, we'll have an example that looks at the reasoning capabilities of ontologies and look at the different aspects of ontologies such as alignment and ontology patterns and reuse and reasoning, of course. To try and understand what we even mean by common semantic content and reusable semantic content. So we'll have time after this for discussion. What we're really trying to do here is pull together, you know, what is the question of reuse? Is it a simple matter of reusing stuff? Are there different lessons to be learnt from these different experiences? And how much common thinking we can bring together on all of that. So slide five, please, is a detailed agenda for today. So we're going to have an introduction to the track topic from Dr. Gary Bergcross, who will be describing the overall problem space of reuse and the different challenges and different dimensions of the problem and so on. And then we'll have the three examples I summarized just now. We'll have Professor Pascal Hitzler talking about ontology patterns for ocean science repository integration. Then we'll have Andrea Westerinen talking about reuse of content from ISO 15926 and from FIBO. And then we'll have Megan Katsumi and Professor Michael Gruninger talking about reasoning about events on the semantic web. And after that, we will open it up for discussion. So without further ado, I'd like to hand on to our first speaker, Dr. Gary Bergcross, please.
Hello, fellow Ontology Summit people. I'm very happy to provide some introductory remarks today before our three main speakers on this topic of reuse and use of semantic material. It's in the context of big data and semantic web meets applied ontology, as Mike noted, and I visually alluded to that in my first slide here. My comments build on what Mike presented at the summit launch last week and his summary just a minute ago. So we can move to slide two. This is my talk outline, starting with a few background slides on the topic issues, challenges, such as communication across the big data, semantic web, and applied ontology. I provide a few examples of how semantic content and methods can help in big data domains such as earth science. And as noted, Pascal will have more to say on this in the next talk. But I also tried to introduce a context from the earth sciences, or Earth Cube in particular, and that's the a work of the Semantic and Ontology Manifesto developed by a work group I was part of, as was Pascal, around some EarthCube organizational workshops. And I finish up with some recap and a list of challenges. Some reference materials are provided in the background, along with some discussion questions as possible follow-up. So, slide three. This is my historical slide, and it notes that knowledge building has long been recognized as a bottleneck, and so knowledge reuse becomes very important since it's difficult to build proper knowledge bases and ontologies. The formalization of ontology has long been looked to as a way forward around some of these bottleneck issues. And I note here that 8 years ago, at the 2006 Ontology Summit, which was about upper-level ontologies, they were widely discussed as a way forward. But I note also in the Upper Ontology Summit Joint Communique, they noted challenges remaining, or we noted challenges remaining, and I quote at the bottom, "The complementary technology for effectively representing the semantic content of complex, widely used concepts is also available, but," as a big but, "agreement on standardized conceptual building blocks has not yet been reached," emphasize on not yet been reached, in 2006. So we have 8 years or so of work. Let's see where we are. So let's move on to slide four, which provides some discussion questions that the track co-champions drafted for the community and forum discussions. For example, have we reached a better consensus on building blocks? What can be reused and how? I note that some discussion activity has started on the forum, coming out of bottlenecks and tools and so forth. The community's issues on the value of large versus small content forms for reuse is one we are very much interested in addressing in this track, and we'll hear more about that in Pascal's talk. There's another question listed on this slide. We can ask if it is reasonable to expect reuse of an entire ontology like Dolce and Semantic Sensor Network. And the diagram on that slide in the bottom is a portion of this SSN ontology. And instead of reusing Dolce, what they did there is aligned with it rather than trying to reuse big pieces of it. This is an approach we might perhaps discuss later here or on the forum. Slide five. Slide five takes us back to this interaction that frames the entire ontology summit, big data, semantic web, ontology applications. Some of the speakers at the launch event loaded last week that the community speak different languages, have different interests. And I've sort of tried to highlight some of those in this slide. So big data speaks about, sort of on the top, I noticed that some of the discussion topics. They speak about data standards, data models, analytics, ISO, metadata catalogs, and the like. While people in the semantic web and linked open data world speak about converting relational data to triples, RDF vocabularies, annotating data with them. The ontology community is more interested in deep knowledge and its representation, semantic alignment, as was mentioned, of content, and wrestles with more foundational issues. However, there is a common share, there's an idea of sharing, data sharing, interoperability, a common ground on which we can start meaningful conversations. We need to show that we can help these communities with their acknowledged problems, and that's what I highlight in slide six. Slide six is a listing of some challenges from the big data and semantic web linked open data world. I took these from the literature as well as comments made at the summit launched last week. I won't read the list, but I do note with some arrows that improved semantic content and its representation helps with a number of these challenges and problems, including data discoverability, semantic search, and metadata annotation. Deeper knowledge should also help provide richer reasoning and faithful support of the initial semantic web vision, which you've gotten a little bit away from, and that's certainly been a topic of conversation on the Ontolog forum. Moving on to slide seven, I provide some examples of possible help that improved semantic might provide in one area of big data, which is from the earth sciences in the area of hydrology. So in this, I've taken material from the Consortium for Universities for the Advancement of Hydrological Sciences Incorporated, or QASI in short. They have several information artifacts to help with their large data sets and their management. They have, for example, a database of observation variables. You see that on the upper left. There are tables for observations like water temperature. And we know things about water temperature from the tables, like its data type and codes. There's a table of units for each observation. It's a pretty big data set of observations. It makes sense, but it has limited semantics. Moving into the center of the diagram, the visualization of this tree-like structure, we see another product on controlled vocabularies developed by QASI for those vocabularies to use the vocabulary to annotate observational data, essentially metadata tagging. But this HydroSeq tool also has limited semantics and even misleading semantics. I've highlighted some of those in the diagram. What seems to be categorizing of observations are really navigational categories and aren't really ontological. They don't really hold up to analysis. Real relations such as constituency and concentration are missing, and they have things like categories like other and so forth that we wouldn't like to have. The third and last QASI component that I show in the diagram is in the lower left. It's what they call their ontology. I just provided a small section of that. But in reality, it's not really an ontology at all. It's a QASI hierarchy of names again. So in summary, all of these things we could help with real semantic content and analysis supporting it. So let's move on to slide eight. I mentioned the content of slide eight before. This is a graphical overview of that semantic ontology manifesto developed as part of EarthCube. This manifesto was started by Pascal and Christoph Janowitz at some meetings I attended. It was contributed to by a number of us who were on the NSF SNO team for EarthCube. I have a link to the actual paper up there, which you're welcome to look at. The manifesto itself includes the idea shown here visually on the left that one could build and insert semantic tech components such as brokers and ontology stores like repositories useful for semantic annotation into existing big data stack infrastructures, which are shown here. They're sort of each science, earth science has its own stack, and the idea is that you need vertical integration within the stack, but you need horizontal integration across the earth sciences. Linked open data is also discussed in the manifesto as an important driver of a useful approach. Going over to the right, there are seven guiding principles. For example, the first one is to drive work by concrete use cases capturing domain and practitioner needs. So be very practical and come from a practitioner's point of view, a domain person's point of view. The second one is something I'll talk about in more detail. The idea of lightweight opportunistic approaches such as the use of ontology design patterns, ODPs, to reduce entry barriers. This is something that Pascal will elaborate on in his talk. And we'll also hear on reasoning services, which is at the bottom. So I won't go through the rest of those, but I will illustrate in the next slide, nine, example of a feeling of lightweight schemas. Here we are leveraging a top-level idea, and we're looking at the bottom, which is actual data, and we're trying to bring these two together. So we have a lightweight schema that leverages simple, very domain concepts. and combines it with two data tables that are on the bottom. So we have a schema here of a bioentity which has biomass, and then it's manifested as two types of weights, dry mass and wet mass, and each can be represented by different units, such as mass units, such as kilograms or grams. These ideas are all brought together so that things from the appropriate tables, columns of the data tables can actually be integrated. I also note in passing that this is sort of like a small module schema, which is easy to understand by domain people. So rather than throwing something like sweet or dulce at domain people, we offer them very simple schemas that they can understand, and we do the harder job of linking and relating that to maybe other ontologies of relevance for other things. Okay, slide 10 illustrates a very simple idea of reuse. So I start with a very simple idea. On top, we have something that's being measured, like a river or some water body, and the temperature of that body is being measured, and you describe the observation as cold, warm, hot, and so forth. Very simple type of thing you see in a database. But we can reuse a larger conceptual model of temperature from things like the Galen biomedical domain. And that Galen model includes other ideas as a part of the schema, the idea of temperature trends, expectations of temperature, absolute states, temperature values. This is an easy knowledge content enhancement to offer domain people to understand it, and it's a nice way of overcoming some barriers of communication. I also show in the upper left side of this, you can do a similar thing on the category itself, the river, so we can add some obvious things about river and formalize this as part of the schema. Okay, slide 11. Now we move from things that semantic content can be used for and improve things in some of those other domains to some of the remaining challenges. This is only a small subsection, obviously, of challenges, but it is things from the literature, and I have three types of things that I talk about in this slide. At the bottom level, we have a language level formatting of semantic content. The problem is we still have some competing standards, and people could use different things to represent the information in ontologies. Some rules may be used to translate between these forms, although moving from less expressive to more expressive forms has issues, obviously. Moving up to the middle level, the ontological level in yellow, there are many more issues covered here, including different conceptualizations based on things like differing scope, granularity, and coverage and the like. Also, scientists use different conceptualizations, so if we're going across things like earth sciences, they have different conceptualizations of vocabulary, although they may have started on trying to bridge the vocabulary problem like QASI. And we need to work with domain people to achieve this type of horizontal integration. Here, the reuse is not only reusing ontologies, but reusing the models that they have developed in the domain and adding semantics to it. So it's sort of two types of reuse. Finally, we have on this ontology level, we have some fundamental issues. I listed some here, such as what concept P, including or similar to concept P, means. Things like SCOS don't really address this, so we need better building blocks if people are need to cover that type of semantics. I note also perspectives, 4D versus 3D in here. And finally, I'm moving to the pragmatic, intentional, and goal level, where these things differ between researchers and projects. There are different goals, different interests, and therefore some of the ontologies need to be changed to accommodate, knowledge needs to be changed to accommodate and make appropriate building blocks between different applications. It's an open question how we handle this, and there'll be some discussion of that within ontology design patterns. To finish up, slide 12 is a six-point recap of some of the high points. So there is a long history of interest in increasing work to leverage, I've noted. There are problems in big data and semantic webs, the work that quality semantics content can help with. There remain challenges, however, in reuse, needing some foundational and practical work. Along with rich and large axiom-rich domains and upper-level ontologies, we should explore lightweight semantics and methods to provide easier entry. Understanding bottlenecks and tools to help with these are topics that other sessions may help with and continue the discussion. 5, opportunities exist in the earth sciences, such as hydrology and ocean science, and we'll hear more about these next. And we should also keep in mind, finally, the idea of the challenges of communicating across the big data, semantic web, and our own disciplines and projects. Well, this has been a very quick introduction to some ideas and concludes my talk. Thanks very much, and I will look on the chat for comments and questions, and some of these we may carry on further on the forum if there is interest. Thanks again.
Thanks, Gary. We're now going to the first of our example presentations, giving us some practical insights into the issues that Gary was just outlining for us. So our first talk is by Professor Pascal Hitzler, who will be talking about towards ontology patterns for ocean science repository integration. So Pascal, over to you.
Thank you very much. How practical this talk is going to be, I'm not so sure. It's a report on work in progress, really. The report on this application-driven work in progress is only part of the talk, because I want to focus more on what we are, what is the concept, the method why we're approaching this, and want to highlight that by more examples than high-level arguments. So I hope that those who are already have done a lot of ontology modeling are not going to be too bored, and I also hope that they won't complain too much with my with regard to my, say, a little bit boiled down examples, which may sometimes be a little bit simplified. So please bear with me. Very happy for that Gary made the high level introduction and mentioned ontology patterns already. Ontology patterns have been around for, I believe, about 8 years or so, and it took me about that time to realize the potential which they really have. So I have to admit I was rather slow in doing that. In the meantime, I think there is a lot of potential, probably even potential which has not been prominently spotted up front. So this is one of the trains of thought I'm currently trying to develop in some of my work. Slide 2, please. The project, which is the kind of motivation for talking, also for some of the work I'm going to present here, is well, I had a lot of collaborators. It's an EarthCube building block project with people from the ocean sciences and some semantic web people. And there's a list of people here, but let's not go through that too much. Slide 3, please. To give you a context, EarthCube, if you haven't heard about it, EarthCube is a long-term NSF effort. I think there was a kind of projected 10 years. I don't know where the discussion is right now. With the goal of, in the words of NSF, developing a community-driven data and knowledge environment for the geosciences. So the idea essentially is there's so much data out there in the earth sciences, and it would give so much added value if this data could easily be shared, reused, combined, analyzed jointly, etc. And earth sciences are missing out on these opportunities simply because the data and knowledge infrastructure is not there. So this is the goal of EarthCube. Next slide, please, slide 4. Now, OceanLink, as one of the projects, the project I'm associated with right now in the EarthCube fabric, actually approaches this from, say, a rather small perspective, but with the idea of providing methods for growth. So if one of the key aspects of EarthCube is integrating data for reuse, for sharing, then OceanLink, in fact, starts doing that in a relatively small domain, still big, of course, but in compared to the size of EarthCube, relatively small, namely the ocean sciences, and in particular with a focus on two of the most prominent ocean science repositories called BICODEMO and R2R. There's links at the end of the slides in the reference section if you want to look them up or just Google them. R2R stands for Rolling Deck to Repository. BICODEMO is a bit longer, but that's easier to Google. Together with some other data sets. So we're doing that. Now, doing that might just sound like a database integration task. Now, so the point here is not to just integrate these repositories. The point here is to do this in such a way that the methods used are extensible and have the potential to in some way grow to EarthCube size. And this is the challenge, because if we talk earth sciences, then we're really talking about a lot. And, it is due to the diversity of the area, diversity of the stakeholders, the dynamics of scientific content, etc., it is probably already clear from this perspective that a classical manually made integration, hard integration of content is just not really sustainable if it is achievable at all. So this is the challenge. This is one of the big challenges. How do we make a data and knowledge infrastructure to do that? Now, next slide, please, slide five. Let me just take a little bit of a shift in the train of thought at this stage. Let's just go back to logic and, of course, logic as something which underlies ontology modeling. And there's a key observation regarding, well, model theoretic semantics, the formal mathematical logic, of course, we're talking about here. There's a very fundamental relationship often expressed mathematically through a Galois connection, but that doesn't really matter here. And the relationship is the following. A theory can either be a strong theory or a weak theory, meaning it can be a theory with a lot of axioms or with a few axioms, of course. The relationship to models in the formal model theoretic sense of say, predicate logic, means that a lot of axioms mean you have a few models for this theory, and in turn, you have many inferences. Few axioms on the other side, meaning you have a weak theory, means you have many models for this theory, but you can draw only a few inferences. And this is a little bit of a shift, or understanding that the logical aspects behind the continuum of reuse and strong modeling. Now, what is strong modeling necessarily? In any case, let's go to slide six and just see the analogy, or one of the analogies which can be drawn to that, to ontologies. If you have many ontological commitments, you have strong ontological commitments, then you have few models, you have a lot of inferences, but you're not very reusable, of course, because you have only a few models. So this would be the realm of, say, almost expert systems, ontology-driven expert systems. Of course, they work in these contexts. On the other hand, if you have few ontological commitments, meaning a kind of weak theory, then you have a lot of models, meaning it's more easily reusable. However, you have few inferences. There's not as many things you really can talk about. So this would be the realm of, say, just reusing a taxonomy with all its inherent ambiguity. So let's go to the next slide, slide seven. And the only thing which changed here to the previous slide is that I put ontology design patterns in the header. Okay, same observations, of course, apply here. Next slide, please, slide eight. So what is an ontology design pattern? And Gary talked a little bit about this already. So let me just use a citation from the ontologydesignpatterns.org website, which says an ontology design pattern is a reusable, successful solution to a recurrent modeling problem. I really like that that phrase. And so-called content patterns, which are a specific type of ontology design patterns, usually encode specific abstract notions, say, such as process, event, agent, etc. Next slide, please, slide nine. I thought it would be nice now to kind of not go further at this stage on the high-level perspective and motivation, but just walk with you through some thoughts which have to do with modeling. I will come back to what we're doing in OceanLink a little bit later. So, let's say we take the notion of event. I found it interesting to use the notion of event because you will get an in-depth talk on event later. So please bear with me. If you think of what's an event, and if you'd like to model event, that you may come up, and there's problems with this slide. There's lots of problems with this slide. Okay, so this is not the end story of it. Then you may say, well, an event has some things, including probably something that it occurs at some time and it occurs at some place. So this would be two things. There are certainly more things. Like an event usually has things or people or agents, whatever, which participate in it, but let's not worry about this right now. We're open world, so we can always model more. Let's just take these two key things of events that, well, they have something temporal and something, well, where they are, place. So we can depict that diagrammatically, and this is not a formal definition. This is just for human benefit as this type of diagram, which we said. And, if you just naively push out data, and you sometimes see these things happening, say, with linked data publishing. You know, somebody would just say, okay, so a place is a string like New York or Mount Everest or whatever, and time is just, well, we have XML schema in OWL and in RDF, so let's just use that. Let's use date time. And, of course, now you can start saying, well, okay, this leads to an axiomatization of this type of knowledge, so geological theory, which in description logic syntax or in a type of description logic syntax is given at the bottom. Every event occurs at some time, which is given as an XML schema, date, time, and same with place. Now, of course, and this is the type of data which, well, you may find. Yeah. Now, those among the audience who've done ontology modeling already noticed that there's things here which are probably not very, very reusable choices. So let's go to the next slide. Let's go to slide 10. And say, well, okay, now talking about time of an event, it's probably a little bit more complex. Probably saying it should be an interval in time might make more sense, but then there may be events which occur at a sequence of intervals, so things get really dodgy here. So at that stage, we might come to the perspective that, okay, the temporal aspect is something temporal. Let's postpone talking about it. Or in other words, let's say, well, actually the temporal thing here is in itself a pattern which needs serious thought to do it right. And we may be able to reuse some things here, like all time, for example, or other things. Now, for the spatial aspect, for the place, we may say, well, perhaps that's a pattern as well, like something like spatial thing. And notice that we are weakening ontological commitments now as opposed to the previous example. So we're going towards being more reusable. Now, occurs at place, spatial thing, and now you could ask, but what about events taking place in Second Life, right? So how far do we want to put that and move that? And we realize at this stage probably that there is a continuum, that we can move along a continuum of specificity and generality. As always in modeling, there is no right or wrong here. But essentially, if we go more general, we are more reusable, but we really lose inferences. We are less sharp in terms of what we're really talking about. So next slide, slide 11, please. So perhaps place is just a place pattern, and participants are just agents. In any case, one of the things which patterns do, other than just being a vehicle for the reuse of information. And yes, of course, now we can look at patterns for place and for agent and for temporal thing and can reuse those. But there is also something else happening here in the mindset of the modeler if you do it this way. And this is that you modularize your modeling, no pun intended. We are now focusing on event and can say, well, okay, there is a notion of place which is important. Let's think about place and what it really is and what constitutes place separately from the event modeling. So in a sense, when you model, you plug in a different pattern and say, well, okay, this is to be done, some other time. Next slide, please, slide 12. So let's look into some almost random observation related to a notion which I tended to call view until Christoph told me that they're in other contexts they're called shortcuts. Anyway, on the left hand side, you see, well, event occurs at place, the place pattern, and on the right hand side you see our first attempt, event occurs at place, which might just have an XML schema string attached. And now it would be easy to say, well, the right hand side is probably just not very well modeled. Now, if we look at something like OceanLink or EarthCube, then what we have to deal with is the variety of the data out there. And it is probably at a certain point not very constructive to say, well, actually, you just have to model your data otherwise because it's not well modeled. if we want to integrate and reuse, then one of the points is that we have to find ways to just deal with data which is modeled from a very high specificity perspective. So how can we map between the two things? Well, even if we do not know yet what the place model actually is going to be like, we probably can already say that it might make sense to say, well, whatever we model the pattern, place, it has a name which is can probably be expressed as a string. Now, I think names are actually much more tricky, but let's stay with the simple example at the moment. And then we can say, well, okay, now can we map between those two? So one of the things you might try here is the axiom, which is below the figures, which on the left-hand side is a property chain. So this is, again, description logic notation. Occurs at place, chained with has name gives us occurs at place. And now you may notice that there are several things wrong here. There are several things which don't really work. One of the things which does not work is that you have occurs at place on the left and occurs at place on the right. And of course you argue, yes, well, one is in the ontology on the left or the pattern on the left. The other one is in the data set at the right. So they're really different. Yes, indeed, they are different. And now looking at something which is common practice, say, in pushing out linked data is an almost naive reuse of vocabulary. Now you have fof name everywhere. It's just as one of the properties, for example. From that perspective, you know, if the occurs at place and the occurs at place at the right are not local to the ontologies, but are global vocabulary with URIs which have an external reference, then well, essentially, the only way to tell them apart is to rewrite it. Okay? This is one of the arguments, the conceptual arguments, why I would say be very careful with the reuse of vocabulary if you push out data. Rather make your local vocabulary, and then for the convenience of those who are interested in it, provide the mapping separately. And say, well, this may be a mapping to external vocabulary. So let's go to the next slide, slide 13. Yes, thank you. At slide 13, we have now put in two namespaces, and there is still a problem. So let's go to slide 14. The equivalence which I gave is actually not expressible in OWL. Only one of the directions is expressible in OWL. Now, is it a problem? Well, it's only a problem if you worry about OWL. And I would argue we should worry about OWL because it's just a dominant mechanism, a dominant vehicle right now. And for me, as somebody who's doing research and description logic, such observations are extremely interesting because they show the limits of description logics, which means it's food for research. In that case, a statement like the one at the bottom, these have been looked at. The problem is they lead to undecidability. Is this really a problem? Well, that's for a different discussion. Okay? We can, of course, always do a first-order logic axiomatization just to pin down the meaning of the pattern. Next slide, please. Slide 15. This slide now essentially shows in a nutshell what happens after the integration. Now suddenly we have the two properties together in the same figure, in the same conceptualization, and going from event to the string is now a type of shortcut. Okay? It's a type of shortcut or a view on the data, while we could probably argue that going through the place is probably the more reusable pattern which we can use. So next slide, please. Slide 16. Just very quickly, another very related example, splitting a role. Say one data set uses the has parent and the other one uses a more fine-grained representation using has father and has mother. Then again, we can, of course, map between those two representations. And the three axioms for this are at the bottom. The only problem, again, here is that disjunction of roles or properties is not something which you have in OWL, for example. Of course, it has been studied in description logic. That's, again, a different discussion. But in principle, yes, you can map between. So let's go to the next slide, slide 17. And now let's go back to the ocean sciences. One thing I learned when starting to interact with the community is that the notion of a cruise, not in the sense of a holiday cruise, but in the sense of an expedition of ocean scientists, is a very, very central event, or there are central events in the lives of ocean scientists. Sometimes it seems like that their lives almost revolve around them. So a cruise, and I mentioned already, a cruise is, you could argue, a type of event. That seems to make sense, right? A cruise is a type of event, so you may want to model it using some event patterns which people put a lot of thoughts in already. And now that might lead to the question, but what kind of place does the cruise occur at? And please go to the next slide, slide 18. And then you may actually come to the conclusion that the place is actually a rather interesting object in its own right, and which actually comes together with the temporal aspect of modeling the cruise. Because the cruise really, I mean, it moves along a trajectory. A trajectory being, well, we have a line segment or something like this, or something more complicated, but adorned with temporal information. So that would be a type of trajectory. So from that perspective, it does not completely fit the bill of event, although at the same time it does. Just thinking about time and place is a little bit more interesting in that case. So let's please advance two slides, slide 20. And I talked about this already. This is a pattern which we have published on a semantic trajectory. So it is an ontology pattern for trajectories. And I talked about this already in some talk here at Ontolog in November. I've given the link in the chat, so if you want, you can look it up there. So I'm not going to talk about this in more detail, also because time is already running out. Needless to say, please advance three slides to 23. What we now have, and this is a draft of what we currently have as a cruise pattern for our purposes. Cruise, you find in the middle. You find the trajectory to the very right in the blue thing, again indicated as a pattern to which we link. And then, of course, there's lots of other things which took us a lot of thought and discussions with the domain experts and the people running the repositories. In trying to achieve a reasonable balance between genericity and specificity, I still call this a pattern, although it's probably not a very generic pattern, but it still is a pattern. Please advance, and we're going to skip a few slides here now. Slide 29, please. So traditionally, ontology design patterns are thought of as building blocks for ontology modeling. We've probably gotten an idea how that would work. I would argue that they can also be used for much more than that. And please go to slide 31 now, and this is almost wrapping it up now already. This is a perspective on, say, the general architecture of what we're doing in OceanLink. We have the patterns we have in the middle. We have repositories at the bottom. We have mappings between them. And on top of the patterns, we have user interfaces, for example, for faceted search. And now, what else could we use the patterns for other than, well, making the ontology for OceanLink? And a perspective one could take here is, well, we're not even thinking about really making an ontology for OceanLink, because that, in terms of growth, would mean we'd have to make an ontology for EarthCube, which I think is just not a good idea. It's too big. So keeping the patterns there and loosely connecting the patterns, but really keeping the patterns as things you identify, keeping the patterns as something which you give to people running repositories and say, just link to the patterns. And the patterns are much more easy to understand than a big monolithic ontology. Driving user interfaces by the patterns, meaning an idea like add a new pattern to the system, and then have a user interface set up which can easily be extended to also deal with a new pattern. Developing special purpose ontology or data ontology alignment systems, which are actually pattern driven, which can help in aligning the specific repositories to the patterns. So I think there is more to patterns than just helping with ontology modeling. Please go to slide 33. So in terms of extensibility, this is what we would be looking for, extend from OceanLink by adding more patterns for other domains and thereby essentially going horizontally in terms of integration. And that's what I wanted to say. Slide 34, thank you very much. There's references in the rest of the slides if you want to look at them.
Excellent. Thanks, Pascal. And thanks for giving us the nice concrete example to the picture on these things. That was extremely helpful. So now we're going to hear from Ms. Andrea Westerinen on her experiences in reuse of content from ISO 15926 and from FIBO, the Finance Industry Business Ontology. And I should add that I have no idea how you got on with FIBO, Andrea, so I very much look forward to seeing what lessons you were able to draw from this. So over to you.
Okay. Actually, I was kind of watching the chat window, too, and the discussion going back and forth about patterns, and I think that my talk kind of merges right into the current theme. So I'm Andrea Westerinen. I'm at a little bitty company with just two people in it called 9 Point Solutions, and I'm doing some work related to network management. And interestingly enough, there are a lot of concepts that overlap with FIBO and with some of the work that was done in ISO 15926. And I'll explain the motivation for why those two particular standards were focused on when I get into the talk. So if you could go to my slide 2, the agenda. I'm assuming that everyone pretty much knows about, or at least has heard about, the 15926 work and FIBO, but I'm not sure people have heard about iRing. And so I just wanted to do quick overviews, like one slide. I don't really get into anything, and there are links for much more information in the talk. But then get into what was the motivation for looking at these standards, and I will also talk about some of the other things that we looked at. The things we specifically chose to reuse, or at least we're still very much in the beginning of this work, so I can't say this is a done deal and this is everything, but what did we choose to use, and then what were our experiences, some of which were very scary to the other people I was working with, mostly because they're not ontologists and they're not into looking at big data models, and they were like totally overwhelmed. So I'll get into that a little bit, and hopefully that can trigger some more discussion both on the mail list and as questions and things like that, and we can talk about it much more. So slide 3, ISO 15926. The way it's characterized in some of the documents that iRing put together and that was put together, it's a babblefish for people that are into the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy for project information. That's the way it was described. So it helps with data integration, exchanging information about an installation, which could be a huge power plant or some kind of, you know, very large construction project with lots of entities involved, lots of people involved. So the customer themselves, maybe tenants, maybe the prime on it, there might be multiple prime subcontractors, people that the vendors you go to for procurement, all kinds of things, and then all the documentation and all the information has to get turned over at the end of a project, and it's a huge, huge deal. But the way the standard was designed was it was designed to be useful outside of the process industry as long as you create your vocabulary for your reference data. And if you go to slide 4, iRing is a user group. It's an acronym for the ISO Real-Time Interoperability Network Grid. these folks got together, and they're the customers. They're the Bechtels and the vendors and other big construction companies who put together a set of tooling to help map local, you know, potentially proprietary databases and information, map that data into the ISO 15926 standard. So, first of all, they wanted to prove that it was indeed possible to do that, and then start to develop some tools to help with that mapping. And they have some tools, and they have a lot of really interesting work that's going on, and develop best practices, which kind of jives with some of the other things we're talking about. And I don't think they call them design patterns, but if you look at some of the work they're doing and the explanations they're giving, you could extrapolate the design patterns. And then actually encouraging people to use it. For companies like Bechtel, it's in Bechtel's best interest for people to use this, you know, common description of things and processes and people and everything to actually bring together all the information to turn over to a customer. So that's what iRing is. And then slide five talks just a little bit about FIBO and the financial industry business ontology. And that's really about getting the financial industry together to support compliance, regulation, governance, reporting back to the government, not to actually get into anybody's financial business themselves, because most of the companies wouldn't want to disclose that kind of information. But what do we need? What does the industry need to do for compliance and governance, market data, you know, some of the common stuff? The way I've always kind of thought about ontologies and some of the work I've done is a lot of companies, because I come more from the commercial side, want to protect their proprietary information or protect the way they do things. But there's a lot of what a company does or has to create in a basic ontology that's really common. Customers aren't going to pay for you to know what a contract is or an agreement is or, you know, a person is. That's not proprietary. It may be what you do with it or what you add on to it or some other things, but these basic definitions are not what distinguish one company from another, and therefore investing money in making proprietary definitions of these things is really not very valuable because it's not what the customers want and it's not where the money is to be made in business. So there's a lot of value in actually getting these common concepts well understood, well documented, and described so that you can move on from there and do more things. So slide six is what we were actually doing in this network management space. One of the motivations is to bring together huge amounts of network data from different products. And so it's very similar to the ISO 15926 process industry problem in terms of its characteristics. You have network management products that talk about asset management. And so you have this very physical-oriented perspective of what your network is and what the pieces are and do you have spares and when are they end of life and things like that. And then you have event analysis, kind of root cause analysis, something went wrong in my network, how do I find it, which is a much more serial look at your network, very, very different than the asset management look. Then you have the trouble ticketing world, which kind of combines the who and the what and the when and what happened and some root cause and this and that. Again, a very different perspective. And if you look at a big enterprise, you'll probably have lots of sites. There won't be just one site. Maybe the sites have been independent over time, so they have their own product set. Maybe one used IBM products, Tivoli products, another used HP products, another used DA products, another maybe built some of their own things and grew it up. You've got Cisco network management things in there. You've got this whole mix of things looking at your network from different perspectives, and it's very difficult, even within a single company, if you stuck with a single company's product, to figure out what you really have in an environment and who all the players are. So that then couples with, now we have a lot of focus on service level agreements and contracts and quality of service for a network and those kinds of things, which actually do start to overlap and bring in all these legal concepts, which the network management world is like has totally kind of ignored for a long time because that wasn't the basis of where network management was coming from. So that was the motivation for looking at the ISO 15926 and also hopefully trying to reuse some of the iRing infrastructure that was developed and for looking at FIBO. But we also started looking at some of the legal ontologies that exist, and maybe I'll just put out an email on the list as to what were some of those that we took a look at, and units and measures and some other things. Maybe talk about that a little bit later. So it wasn't like we just said ISO 15926 and FIBO are the end. It was just that was like a very big focus of the things we went to look at. Now the other thing is, we were on kind of a small budget with a tight time frame to put something out there to show progress, because it's always important if in the commercial space to not say I'm going to go away for a year and I'll come back with something, but to show incremental progress. So there was no desire or reason to go create an ontology either from the top down or the bottom up. And there was a lot of interest in reusing tools, infrastructure, thinking that had already went into the work. So you could kind of say we, for this project, took a middle-out approach. We were like, what are the main things we want to do? What's our initial focus? Then what can we use? What are generalizations and what are specific things that we need? So we really took a middle ground kind of approach to the development. Slide 7, if you take a look at it, this is the part where I actually get into what did we find that was really useful. And I would almost say this aligns with Pascal's content patterns. We certainly weren't going to take 15926 in its entirety or even FIBO in its entirety, but what did we find that was really interesting and what was valuable to us? The concept in the ISO standard for what's a possible versus an actual individual, there's a lot of work in network management that goes into planning. What will my network be if I add another router here, or if I increase the bandwidth, or if I, you know, shut down this thing, or if I change my DNS servers, or things like that. There's a lot of focus on here's what my network is today, what will my network be tomorrow? Maybe I'm bringing on a whole new building or something like that. So this concept of possible individuals versus actual individuals was really very valuable, because I've been in different companies that struggled with that concept a lot, and the way the ISO approached it was really quite valuable. And then the concept of properties and indirect properties. A property of something is like, you know, the current temperature of my fan or my container or something like that. And then there are indirect properties, which would be like something like the max operating temperature. So it is not a characteristic or what they call a direct property of a thing, but it's indirect. It's information that's relevant to that container, that motor, that fan, whatever. Again, that's valuable in the networking world because you need to know the specs. The indirect properties are specs and other things like that. And then there are the things like all the activities, which comes back to events very clearly. But they are also not just events, but could overlap with process, and indeed process is one of the things that's in ISO that have beginnings, they have endings. And if you think of trouble ticketing, that trouble ticketing space, this whole activities thing is very valuable. If I'm configuring, I'm monitoring, I'm following, I'm creating, completing, those kinds of things. Roles are always big in any kind of network management space or even any kind of access and security space. Role-based access control is still probably the primary way of doing security. But then there's also all the supporting information that ISO provided for the physical things or events or other information. So there's notes and data sheets and guidelines and things like that. And I didn't feel like those were formalized enough. They were more, it's a blob of information kind of thing, but it was all going in the right direction. Slide 8. The other things we picked up, there was an extensive units of measure and set of work that was done there because everything needs to be understood in terms of, you know, are you talking about Fahrenheit or centigrade temperatures or what are the units for anything. But we also didn't want to just pick up the ISO. Now, admittedly, the ISO stuff came before QUDT ontology on quantities and units and those kinds of things. So when I say interlaced with the QUDT, we're kind of trying to make sure that we have all the bases covered if we just do the QUDT, which comes from W3C. Clearly, the concept of system as being composed of more discrete components, that there's no, you know, specific, there is a specific concept of a system, but it doesn't exist as a single non-decomposable entity and the features within it. All the physical work in ISO was very valuable, although it was far more oriented, obviously, to the process industry. It would have been really cool if we could have reused the concept of a connection. But it was really too physically defined, you know, it's transferring matter energy or both. You can certainly, given that, you know, E equals MC squared, you could say that any kind of wire or thing like that or a wireless is transferring matter and energy, but it really kind of came across in the way its connectors were defined and everything as far too physical. So we kind of needed to go beyond that. Slide 9. So to use iRing is all based on ISO. Pardon me?
5 minutes.
Oh, okay. I better hurry up then. To use iRing, we definitely needed to extend things. So I'll just skip over slide 9, go to slide 10. Slide 10 will be faster because it's a little more obvious. The concepts we picked up from FIBO were about the agreements and the commitments and the contracts, those kinds of things, the autonomous agents and roles and locations. The location was pretty cool because when you get to the, I have to know what building something is, what room, those kinds of things, that physical location was a good start, but then we needed to go deeper in the network management space to describing place. And a lot of the things, we took a lot of information, if you look at slide 11, from just the property definitions in FIBO. The concepts like causes, constraints, controls, it has member, is part of, involves, those things. There was a lot of insight we took from the object properties. We took them pretty much wholesale. The data properties like the acquisition date, the address components, as I said, we went beyond that a bit. And then the annotation properties, we were really impressed with how well annotated the FIBO models were as a model for using and for doing our work in the network management space. So slide 12, our experiences with ISO 15926, which I think is kind of universal when you get to any big ontology, that there were a lot of valuable concepts there, but we really needed more insight than the ontology and the documentation itself provided. So when you coupled the, like, ISO 15926 Part 2 information with the domain-specific insights of Part 4 and Part 7 has the templates of how you use things, it got way more insightful than looking at part two all by itself. The problem was the 15926 was too physically oriented, and we actually looked all over the place to get a good feel for what it actually was. You know, there was a beginner's guide to modeling. There were some papers written. There was browsable interfaces, which typically scare people. This ISO15926.net was not written by an ontologist or anybody who really knew modeling, but more from a, I'm a user and I need to find things. So it was a targeted browser. That was actually really valuable, which is kind of scary that the thing when somebody says, I'm not an ontologist and I don't really know what I'm doing, when you find that interface more usable than the standard ones, it kind of says something. And then there were the OWL definitions. On slide 13, very clearly, 15926 was intimidating. Most of the people, you know, we kind of, there were some people that kept just plugging away at it, and, which is what you do. But it was also difficult because the annotations were separate from the class definitions and when you downloaded the OWL files and stuff. And the definition itself was generated from Express, which meant it didn't really flow into OWL very well, and it didn't, it had a very limited kind of use of OWL, and it was an OWL 1 DL definition. If you go to slide 14, now the FIVO experiences, that reuse was more limited because FIVO was more targeted, but it was also much more obvious to people what we wanted, what was useful, what we would need to extend. The OWL definitions were clean. There was good annotation. There were nice small files. The problem is that they were very circular, though. When you tried to pull in one RDF file, you pretty much, any of the higher level ones, you pretty much pulled in everything else. They were all imported. So it was kind of, it was hard to say, I just want this piece without pretty much taking all the other pieces, but we worked around it. So we could actually import and then prune a little bit. It's still, FIVO is still early in the development. The things that are standardized are still very generic, but the team is actually looking forward to more things coming out. It was really easy to get. There was a zip file. It had everything we needed except the specification metadata, which was pretty obvious, but it was just annoying if you import something and it keeps into like something like Protégé and you keep getting, do you know where this file is? Do you know where this file is? Do you know where this is? It's like, no, nope, we told you already, just get over it. Oh, but anyway, it was truly defined in OWL to start with. So last slide is 15, general comments. It was very difficult to find specific semantics in these big ontologies. We couldn't reuse them fully because they were way too big, and but we did reuse pieces, parts. Some other general small ones were imported and used directly, like the QUDT, the W3C time, the provenance ontologies. And we found that the targeted semantics were extremely useful in getting us started. It wasn't an open-ended, what do we think we need? It was, let's look at this. Does this meet our needs? Where do we need to go? Which is much better for the team than looking at a blank sheet of paper and trying to, you know, architect something from whole cloth. It gave a good perspective because it gave room to grow. It was a different perspective, a more complete analysis than if we had just looked at it from, I want to do trouble ticketing and network management alone. And in all, the experience was great, but it was difficult. So that's it for me.
Thanks, Andrea, and thanks for your kind words about FIBO. It's worth noting that a lot of the things you found useful were work that was done over the summer with our partners at the Object Management Group, such as Elisa Kendall from Thematics. So it's a great validation of that, and a good continuation of this whole conversation about what it takes to make things reusable and how some of the things that make one thing more usable make another thing more difficult. We're talking about modularity and so on and patterns in the chat, and that was the very thing that caused you other things to struggle with. So thanks very much for that excellent perspective. And next we have Ms. Megan Katsumi and Professor Michael Gruninger of University of Toronto, who will be talking about reasoning about events on the semantic web. So over to you two.
Okay, so I'll be going through the slides, and then I think Michael will be finishing off with a couple thoughts at the end of the talk. So thanks for having me today. I'll be talking a little bit about some of the work that we're doing in Toronto with event ontologies, where we've encountered some big picture questions. And if you just move to slide two, you'll see that they're pretty closely aligned with this year's summit. And some of them, I think, are questions that have actually been raised already, such as how are semantic web and big data applications using ontologies? What kinds of ontologies are required by these applications? If ontologies meeting these requirements exist but are not being used, what are the reasons? And if ontologies that meeting these requirements do not exist, how can they be designed? So as I mentioned, these were encountered in our work that's currently in progress, and we're looking at reasoning on the semantic web. So if you move to slide three, we've observed currently that most event ontologies on the semantic web are employed for annotation and retrieval, but we're kind of unclear on what kinds of reasoning is being done with these event ontologies. And with all of the annotated data, because with all of the annotated data that's available now, we think that there's many opportunities for reasoning that are not currently being addressed. Next slide, please. So this slide illustrates just a few of the potential applications that we've identified. For example, in the emergency response domain, there could be reasoning about whether or not two reported incidents are potentially related to better inform responders. For context awareness, there could be reasoning about potential delays in a specific area or path of interest. In municipal planning, we could do reasoning about to plan maintenance activities, for example, during which time periods are no events scheduled at some location in the city, and also for recreational events. So moving on to the next slide, please. So we're on slide five. So collectively, all of these observations sort of raised the questions, raised some research questions for us. So are semantic web ontologies able to support these kinds of non-trivial reasoning problems? If not, why not? Could it be the case that existing ontologies on the semantic web simply aren't designed with enough semantics to support these applications? Or is it that they've reached the limit of what semantic web languages can support? So investigating these questions is ongoing work in our lab. And moving on to the next slide, slide six, the work that we're doing now, we're using the reasoning abilities of PSL as a reference point, and our ontology or our investigation is focused on a few well-known semantic web ontologies, specifically the simple event model, LODE, and the event ontology. Moving on to the next slide, just a brief introduction for those of you who are unfamiliar with PSL. Or the process specification language. It's a modular first order theory of activities and their occurrences. So in other words, it's you can like a theory of events. And in slide seven, you see an illustration of the hierarchy, the different modules in the PSL theory. And then moving on to slide eight, this slide addresses a few points on why we felt it was a suitable reference point for our investigation, which I'll describe subsequently. So PSL is a well-known and mature theory, and it gives a relatively detailed and deep semantics for events. And so you'll see why this is important in the next slide, or the next couple slides, hopefully. So moving on to slide nine. From PSL and our selected semantic web event ontologies, we created the following ontologies. So we created an OWL version of PSL, where we basically translated as much of the semantics as we could from the first order axiomatization into OWL. And then using this OWL version of PSL, we created non-conservative extensions of each of the three event ontologies that we're looking at. And the idea was essentially that this would create a spectrum of ontologies for us to work with in both OWL and first order logic. And then we would use these ontologies and evaluate them against the set of competency questions that would be derived from our motivating scenarios of potential reasoning applications on the semantic web. So moving on to slide 10, I think it's worth noting that we also created a swirl axiomatization of PSL, and then in a similar fashion, we extended the three event ontologies and created swirl versions. And in with this approach, we're able to preserve more semantics, but for the time being, they're being excluded from our investigation because we've found that the reasoning support for swirl is pretty limited right now. So moving on to the next slide, slide 11 illustrates the hierarchy of theories, which is basically the spectrum that I was referring to previously. So you can see at the bottom of the hierarchy, we have the original OWL event ontologies that we've selected for the investigation, and their non-conservative extended using the PSL, the OWL version of PSL that we created. So moving on to slide 12, the idea behind this, creating this kind of spectrum is sort of twofold. So the first point is that using the relationships between PSL and the event ontologies and sort of characterizing the mappings between these event ontologies, we can identify what semantics are shared between them. And we also want to be able to use the competency questions derived from motivating scenarios to distinguish between the different extensions of the same ontology. So what do we get from adding these additional axioms in the extensions? And also what role does the ontology language play in the reasoning abilities that we're looking for? So moving on to slide 13. Here you see sort of an outline of our plan to evaluate each of the event ontologies and assess its either ability or inability to support the example reasoning problems that we generated. So, for example, the first thing that we would do is attempt to formalize a particular query in the ontology signature, and whether or not we're able to do that would sort of indicate whether it's a restriction in the query language of the ontology or not. And if in following along with this example, if it's not a restriction on the query language, then it could be the case the ontology is missing concepts. So it's an issue with the breadth of the ontology. Sort of going along the lines, if the query is definable, then we have sort of further steps developed that would indicate, depending on whether or not the query is answered successfully, what the case may be. And that should sort of become clear in the next slide when I'm talking about the different cases. So slide 14 illustrates a breakdown of what we've identified as the possible outcomes of this evaluation. And basically, these correspond to answers to original research questions. In other words, whether the kind of reasoning that we're interested in is possible with these existing event ontologies, and if not, why not? So if you're looking at the different cases, there's case one, which is if we're able to perform the reasoning problem successfully with the original event ontologies, and then you look at where that reasoning is not possible, what are the possible explanations? So it could be an issue of missing concepts or missing axioms. And it could also be an issue of insufficient scope or breadth. So I think just moving on to the last slide here, slide 15. So you'll see the first point here is kind of a bigger picture of motivation for the work that we're doing here. which is that we believe that the development of these kinds of reasoning applications may serve to also promote more use of ontologies on the web. And also, if successful in this work, we hope to provide guidance on what is required if we want to be able to form these kinds of non-trivial reasoning applications with ontologies on the semantic web. So at the point that we're at right now, it seems that current axiomatizations of event of these event ontologies on the semantic web are too weak to specify and entail the competency questions that we've extracted. But it's sort of remains to be evaluated what we can do with the extensions that we've created. And it also seems that one useful avenue would be to identify techniques to prove that we have a maximal subtheory of a common logic ontology in a given language, so that we can say, for example, with the translations of PSL to OWL, that we've said as much as we can in a particular language. And that's all that I have, so I'll hand it over to Michael now to sort of conclude.
Thanks, Megan. Yeah, so I just wanted to make a couple of other points here, and also how it's related to some of the things we've seen before today. So one is looking at reuse as a relative notion. So the idea that we want to be able to reuse an ontology or set of ontologies for a particular application or set of applications. And so there's the need to be able to say, is this ontology, can I reuse this ontology for the applications that I want to be able to do? And how can we evaluate that? I think the other, one of the other themes that we had here, which is related to Gary's earlier slide 9, is that what we're doing in this approach here is that we're extending what you might call the lightweight ontologies with the axioms of a more heavyweight foundational ontology, such as PSL. So I see this kind of corresponds to what Gary said on his presentation in slide 9. And it also involves mappings between the ontologies. And this last point on slide 15 harkens to Gary's slide 11, where, as Megan said, we want to be able to show that, say, this PSL.OWL is the best, it is the maximal OWL expressive, say, fragment of PSL. So if you want to be able to reuse the PSL ontology within OWL, then PSL.OWL represents that maximally reusable portion of it. And then finally, the other thing that to emphasize with what Megan was saying too is that you're looking at reasoning not only as an application, but also looking at reasoning as a way of evaluating the adequacy of an ontology for reuse. And so this kind of goes to Pascal's slides when he's talking about few axioms or more axioms, and you can allow more inferences, more deductions with a stronger ontology. And so this is really looking at this exploration of how far can you extend a particular existing ontology, perhaps within a particular ontology language. And when on the second bullet on slide 15, when we're saying, oh, it's too weak to specify and entail, say, the competency questions that we extracted, well, this again goes back to Pascal's slide. So the idea being that your requirements are being for reuse are being specified as competency questions, and then you're determining, well, what kind of ontology do I need in order to answer those? And so I may be able to reuse an ontology, but I may have to also extend it. So I can't just reuse it as is, but I may have to reuse it and then extend it. And this kind of goes back to one of Tara's comments about, you may need to actually change the semantics, if you will, because you're adding additional axioms. And then finally, one of the kind of applications of what presented is that effectively we're kind of using the mappings between the different event ontologies almost as the ontology patterns. And so essentially the mappings between those three semantic web event ontologies to PSL identifies what's common among all of those ontologies. And so, again, the theme for this particular track is common reusable semantic content. And so the idea is not only looking at reusability, but also commonalities. What's shared? What are the shared semantics among a set of ontologies? And that's also what we're able to do by doing this mapping into this more foundational ontology, such as PSL. And I've mentioned this on the chat, but also just to mention it again, So within Kalori, the Common Logic Ontology Repository, we find all the common logic axiomatizations. But since we want to keep that just common logic, all the different OWL axiomatizations, we will be uploading to the AutoHub repository. So that's it. I think, Megan, do you have any other comments? Okay, that's it. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks, Michael, and thanks, Megan. I think that's a good way to round up the tour that we've had of different approaches and experiences and so on in ontology reuse. So, yes, part of what we've been trying to get to here is some idea of what are the things one has to think about, what are the maybe the rules, the metadata you might need, and so on. So we've got a half hour now for open discussion. So thanks everyone for keeping the time. That was very much appreciated. I think we'll progress in the usual way by if you click on the raise hand thing to raise your hand and put yourself in the queue. Don't write to the left of it, whatever you do. And we'll take questions as they come up. So who wants to go first? Oh, Peter Yim, you're up next.
Okay. Yes, this question for Megan and Michael. It looks like Megan has answered it on the chat now. I think it's a great talk and a great approach to systematically answer these very important questions. So I was wondering whether there is some documentation that supports those, at least those preliminary results now. And of course, I'm sure they will be writing up a paper elsewhere. Maybe Megan can elaborate on that.
So, yeah, so Megan just typed it in. So we can, will also be we can kind of send out and distribute some of the drafts of the paper with a lot of the technical details for people to kind of see, sort of a bit of a preprint.
Right. Yeah, because this is so relevant to this ontology summit, and don't know the timeline of your paper. I mean, sometimes I'm in journal papers and it might take the next 6 months. By then, the summit is over.
Well, that's a good deadline, yeah. We'll get it done before the end of the summit, for sure.
Phenomenal. Thanks.
Excellent, thanks. Andrew, you're up next. There we are.
Okay, there we go. I had to unmute myself again. Sorry. There were some comments in the chat that I thought were worth highlighting. You know, people were kind of going down the discussion points of even in a large ontology, there's small reusable content. There's some really valuable insights, and if there would be a way to highlight those, maybe talk about where an ontology picked up maybe a small piece from another ontology and reused it, even if it was extended, coupled maybe with the mapping information or the extension information, how you might reason over it. It seems like these smaller concepts or smaller semantics, I don't know if I want to go as far as saying they're design patterns. Maybe they're bigger than just a pattern, but they're a small, consistent glob of semantic content. That would be really valuable, and to know, you know, like, here's how you do events in the ISO 15926, and here's an event maybe in FIBO, when FIBO gets to that, or, you know, that these concepts would be more easily found and highlighted, and then understood how they're extended. That might be a valuable contribution that we could make in this summit.
Yes, I think so. Anybody got any good examples they can quickly think of or type in? We've seen events in a couple of those talks, and that does seem to be a very fundamental one. But what other experiences have people had on that?
Well, just to maybe answer a little bit too, it seems like concepts of like physical entities and people and the places, the legal concepts, depending on what you're doing, it doesn't all have to be like universally applicable, just common sense applicable,
Yes, I think that's a very important point. So, does anybody else want to expand on that before we go on to the next point? Or yes, I think Gary makes the point, the cruise pattern that Pascal built out from the event pattern was an interesting example. Another thing we've done in Fiber is build out the concepts of activities and use those to build concepts within process based on building out events. So an event on its own may have some cause, but an event that some actor acts in is some activity, and then building out from there. But then straight away you get to the point where different people might have different ways of looking at it. What does anybody think? Okay, Simon, you're up next.
This is a question for Megan and Michael. Michael's answered one of my questions already about why F was not used, or it's relaying a question on from Ryan Shaw, one of the things that Ryan noted was that LODE was not explicitly designed for reasoning, so the evaluation of a ontology that was not designed for reasoning to see how well that works is possibly going to give some very interesting answers on reusability and modifiability. But the answering strategy is the competency questions that you go into that you discuss but like aren't really outlined. In Ryan's dissertation, which is looking at description of events, and is doing a lot of different historiographical, ontological, and epistemological stances, and a lot of either uncertainty or no necessarily fact of the matter, or roughness or fuzziness of boundaries, and I was wondering like what sort of evaluation you're doing to deal with combining different viewpoints, especially on the linked data, semantic web, multi-perspectival context. And I'll shut up now.
Megan, do you want to say anything? No? So I guess the first point that you made, dealing with, LODE was originally designed for other purposes, and so wasn't designed for reasoning. That's a good point, and we're not. I don't think this evaluation should be considered to be like criticisms of other ontologies. It's simply more kind of evaluating the adequacy for reuse. And so that's an interesting question: is when an ontology designed for one purpose, is it reusable for another purpose? Where the requirements for that earlier reason are very different from the requirements for the second one. So I think that's a really interesting kind of question that as ontology designers and users we have to address. The second point also is kind of interesting because this has been widely discussed. There's a workshop that often is a kind of a sister workshop at the ISWIC conferences called DERIVE. I can't remember what does DERIVE stand for. But it deals with events on the web and reason with event ontologies, et cetera, kind of like identifying events in Twitter feeds and things like that. And definitely there you're up against, did I correctly annotate a particular web resource with this event information or not? And, there can be You can have two people watch a movie and have them describe what happened, and they'll give completely different descriptions about what they just saw. And so even though they're using the same ontologies, they're actually using that same ontology in a different way. I think that's another big challenge I think we're only beginning to kind of encounter in meaningful ways.
Yeah, okay. Just going to say that, he explicitly took it as not a criticism, but as a pretty neat idea. Interesting.
Thanks, Simon. Does that cover everything that you were asking about? Great. John Yanosi, you're up next. Star 7 and unmute locally if you haven't already. John?
Yes, I just posted a question on chat for Andrea regarding the network management ontology concept. Having some experience in this area in network provisioning and planning, I view the network ontology as very important for the overall planning process. My question is relates to the issue of external mathematical models relating network element performance characteristics, whether they be availability, cost, and utilization, the higher level of network element performance variables, both static and dynamic. So I was wondering what Andrea thought or perceives the role of an ontology in that particular reasoning context.
That's a really interesting question. And we have just started to touch on that. Some of the work and the thinking we've done is how do you do roll-ups or how do you do composition into these higher level concepts, and are there rules that the operators can define as to how you want to do a roll-up even of a problem? You know, I have a problem in this entity, it's a high priority entity in, you know, some process, my billing process or my customer fulfillment process or something. Therefore, a problem there constitutes a major problem in the network. You know, can we use, and that's kind of where the swirl came in and everything, to help figure out the roll-ups and things like that. But from the mathematical perspective, we clearly have a problem with OWL, which has no math, and SWIRL, which has some math, but which is basically why we were using SWIRL also. But we haven't gone very far, and that would be another very interesting kind of thing to understand whether, because I can't really answer it, whether an ontology makes sense in this context, or it's more the reasoning or the inference that makes sense coupled with the ontology. And then also probabilistic reasoning, I think, comes into this play too in terms of planning. So that would all be something really amazing and interesting, I think, to understand.
Thank you. I agree. It's an area requiring more expert exploration. And probabilistic reasoning, yes, that brings another perspective that I think that provide clues for network craft people or others who are troubleshooting, listing possible causes for a network level symptom.
Exactly. That was my exact. Yeah, you hit it.
Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed the conversation and your presentation.
Oh, thanks.
Thanks, John. Any other questions for the speakers, or any more general points that anyone would like to throw into the mix in terms of what it takes to do reuse of ontology? Well, see, one recurring theme Ali Hashemi has mentioned a couple of times is how one distinguishes between the semantics of a concept versus being able to reason about that concept. The queue's filling up again, but I just wondered if anybody, Michael perhaps, or somebody wanted to take that as a question.
Could you just repeat the question?
How do you distinguish between the screen moved while I was reading it, but how do you distinguish between the semantics of the concept and being able to reason about that concept?
For us, I think it really comes back to, like I said, I think Pascal had those slides that kind of captured that a lot. The philosophers here will attack me for saying things like this, but I think, you know, there's kind of a pragmatic side to semantics insofar as, I believe that we would share the semantics of a particular term if we also share the inferences about that. So if I say, giving you a particular kind of scenario, and I say, well, based on that, I can infer this, then if we share the same semantics, then you would agree to that. And so we really kind of tie together the semantics with the kind of inferences you can do. And in essentially, that's kind of the role that competency questions play, right? That you want if you say my ontology needs to be able to support answering this particular question, then you write enough axioms until you actually can do that. So for us, there's quite an identity there, but that's a definite philosophical position that not everyone's going to agree with.
Interesting. Thanks. The reason I alighted on that question is, yes, I wouldn't call myself a philosopher at all, but when we started building Fibo, we really took a very pragmatic point of view. So, for example, somebody came up with a concept for something that had a time and a place, and I went, well, that's an event. And so we defined event in terms of the things one could sensibly say about it. The part of moving into the more formal RDFL and the stuff that Andrea was showing us is turning that around and thinking more about what conclusions one can draw or what competing questions what one can answer. So it's an interesting dynamic, you know, between those two ways of approaching meaning. So, thanks for that. Michael, you're up next, in fact. You have a question or comment?
Well, right, I noticed Gary's right behind me, so this was kind of a question for Gary and I guess indirectly for the organizers of Track A. Gary didn't get to his last slide. I think, as Ali pointed out, there's a lot of really interesting questions on that last slide, slide 15. Gary, did you want to say any more words about that? Because those are really great questions.
Hello. Hopefully you can hear me. These were created by the co-champions, and indeed, Andrea created most of them, and we edited them a little bit. So they're not questions that we had specific answers for, but thought that the community might like to discuss them. So if you're interested in a particular question, we can start it here, but we're particularly interested in continuing on the forum. Andrea, do you have anything more to say about that question? I think you crafted that.
As you said, I didn't have any answers. I more was like, I would love to hear. I mean, certainly I have thoughts, but that doesn't mean that there are any kind of answers. But these were really to get the discussion going on the list. And what we were afraid of as co-champions is that if we put out every question in one big email, that we would, one, get a fracturing of the threads going all over the place. So we were kind of thinking about doing this much more segmented and specific and really getting discussions going on each of these topics. But when I think about reuse, those were just things that came to the front of my mind just as I was, you know, thinking about the problem in general.
I had my hand up because I did wanted to I asked the community while we have people online if they have topics that they think they would like to hear in the second session. We have some people already lined up, but we don't have a full slate. So I wanted to make sure the community understood that we're sort of open to topic areas and maybe people that you'd like perhaps to hear on this issue.
Yes, I think either by raising your hand or star sevening or even typing into the chat. I think there's really two ways we see this track taking this issue forward. And one is to look at more examples, and we'd love your ideas about examples or things to hear about for the next session. And the other is to what extent one can pull together a body of theory around this. We've seen some glimpses of that today, and I wonder what it will take, maybe even in the next 10 minutes, to pull together something of an agenda for figuring out what that body of theory is or what the variables are. So I put one question on the mailer, and there was an outbreak of tumbleweeds. So perhaps we should just put the 7 questions up and let the email thread explode. I don't know. They are excellent questions. Anyone? So if not, we've got a couple more questions queued up. Gary, are you still queued up with another comment as well, or?
No, my comment was an invitation to suggest topics and speakers of interest for the second session.
Thanks, Gary. Michael, you have a comment or a suggested speaker?
Just as a comment relating to your last kind of thing for some future progress here. As Andrea noted, there was a lot of discussion, and it came up in a lot of the talks, you know, along the, you know, generated by the theme of ontology design patterns, but also along the lines of modularity and you know, the interaction between modularity and reusability. That might be something that we can have as a, I don't know, some way we can somehow roll that out. And I think that kind of does look at your question, the question 4 that you guys put together, the one that's on slide 15. But that might be something that's concrete enough that we could actually do something, kind of explore, you know, modularity in some way and design patterns. I'm not sure how, but I think that might be the best way to get something concrete and done.
I think that's an excellent idea. I think the experiences Andrea had with modularity, both in 15926 and in FIBO, and the experiences we had in FIBO of working out how modular to make it, perhaps there's more to think about in terms of fitting that modularity around common design patterns or blobs. I prefer blobs because design patterns suggest that you're designing a solution rather than documenting the problem space. But I think modularity is a big issue to explore. Should we see if we can put something together on that for the next Track A session and try and see if we can find any speakers that have specific insights or experience on that?
So, Mike, the other thing we can do is start talking on the list, too, about it.
Yes, excellent idea. Let's do that. Yes, and as Gary points out in the chat, the question on bottlenecks will probably feed into that that conversation as well on Track C. Cool. John McClure, do you have a question or another idea for the next session?
Yes, thank you very much. I apologize for the delay there. I wanted to give the general thought that if reusability is somewhat a function of the size of the ontologies that are at issue, maybe some analysis of why ontologies in general are being so are so large. You know, it's not clear that just modularizing a large ontology into smaller domains is necessarily going to put us onto a road of reusability, because presumably those individual modules will become larger and larger themselves, as well as having greater and greater interdependencies, always a problem in software development. So one idea is to, you know, basically inventory the number of classes and properties and individuals that we find in ontologies as a way to just pretty much put our arms around the scope of this problem. Any thoughts about looking into why ontologies that have such rich axiom and like content, why are they so large you know, and even Andrea talked about it in her presentation about the tens of, I think she referenced tens of thousands of items in that one ontology. I mean, clearly we all know that there's a cognitive boundary related to the size of anything for any particular human to get their wrap their mind around it. So that's my comment for the next session on reuse.
Thank you. One thing that immediately strikes me on listening to that is remembering last year's hackathons, and there were at least two hackathons which looked at ontology evaluation. On one of them, we drew together elements of the OOPS and OCREA methodologies as ways of assessing the sort of thing you're describing, you know, the number of classes, the number of axioms, and so on. I don't know, Maria Provedi, you were on that as well, whether you want to take that comment as well, that perhaps in looking at reuse, part of it is what things we want to analyze about an ontology to understand its reusability.
If someone were to know of a link to such a study, that would be enormously helpful to many of us, I'm sure.
Ontology Summit 2013 hackathon. Excellent. A couple more hands up. We've got 2 minutes to go. I'm assuming, Gary and John, you put your hands up and didn't put them down again. Did you still have stuff that you wanted to say, or if not?
No, I don't know how to get off it.
All right. You just take the hand icon again.
Thank you.
We'll try and make a little bit of time for a wrap up as well. Right. Steve Ray?
Really pragmatic question. I was wondering if anyone knew of a way, or has anyone done a study on, assuming you have a concept you're thinking of including in your own ontology, finding other ontologies that include that concept. So in other words, let's say you were dealing with time and you want to find ontologies that use time, or dealing with, a mereological, whole part relation, which ones do that? So it's sort of in a more granular resolution I'm looking, rather than saying, looking at an ontology repository where it's you have to pick through each one to see which one has that concept.
You mean you can't search using text because you want to really find the meaning of the thing?
Yeah, anyway. Sort of a word net for concepts appearing inside ontologies.
Anyone got any quick pointers on that? We're running a bit short of time, so yeah, go on.
Actually, Steve, your comment was pretty much what I was going to say, and John, back to you. I never intended or never thought I would ever reuse an ontology like FIBO directly for network management, and the network management ontology will really be a set of ontologies, not just one. But I actually, in some of the work I did on my last contract, used WordNet. And I created an annotation property that was the WordNet synset from the definition from the Sparkle endpoint, or its hypernym or hyponym if the word wasn't exactly there, in the hopes that someday we could start to use that concept to get back to the real semantics of what I was trying to get to.
Interesting. To talk more.
Thanks.
Yeah, I'll put that on the chat. But it was interesting, and a lot of people said, "Oh, that's cool." And then some other people said, "Oh, well, that's too hard. I'll have to actually look it up." And I was like, "Yeah, you will."
Excellent. So with just over time, I was just going to ask Gary and Andrea to wrap up. I see Gary has already had to jump off. But Andrea, do you want to make some closing, wrapping up comments to bring this to a close? Okay. So I think we've got
Sorry. I was going to say myself back on mute. The only closing comment I'd like is I would love to continue these discussions on the mail list. There's a lot of really good ideas there, and I was really excited with the both conversation and the speakers today. Thank you, everybody. And I'm looking forward to the summit.
Thanks, Andrea. Me too. And thank you all, everyone. I think we'll start by putting these seven questions up on the mailer as seven different things and see if we still get tumbleweeds. But do jump in on those. Thanks, everyone, very much for a very informative and productive session. And we hope to see you all for session three next Thursday, 30th of January, at the same time, 12:30 Eastern US time, 5:30 in London, and so on, where we'll have the first session of Track B. So thank you, everyone.